You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 20:00 in Tokyo, 14:00 in Tel Aviv, midday here in London, and 8 a.m. in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller, coming up on today's programme. Hundreds of thousands take to the streets in over 50 locations across Israel to protest Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's handling of the Gaza war. The trilateral security pact AUKUS considers becoming JAUKUS. The security of Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant once again becomes cause for concern. And finally, we're joined by Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco for a look at the papers. Faye, what's on the agenda today?
Hello, Andrew. Today we look at the spat between Mexico and Ecuador and another spat between Elon Musk and a Brazilian Supreme Court judge.
A pair of spats. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing. I'm Andrew Muller. Yesterday, Israel commemorated the passing of 6 months since Hamas's attacks of last October 7th, which killed at least 1,200 people and prompted an ongoing war which has left the Gaza Strip substantially in ruins and killed over 33,000 Palestinians. Among the observances of the half anniversary of October 7th were protests in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities against the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under various and considerable pressures before the conflict began, he is also criticised for Israel's failure so far to secure the release of perhaps 130 hostages still held by Hamas. I'm joined in the studio with more by Daniela Pellad, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Daniela, first of all, there were huge weekly protests before October 7th against Netanyahu across Israel. Are these protests to any extent continuations of those?
Yes, to a large extent they are a continuation. I mean, what was interesting about those protests is that they spanned really quite a large portion, range of Israeli demographics. So it certainly wasn't protest by the left or the shrinking left or whatever remains of the left in Israel. It was really much more mainstream. So there is a continuation of that protest movement. But I think what's also really important to note is these aren't anti-war protests. Mm. The war still retains a very high degree of support amongst the Israeli public, the Jewish Israeli public, I should say, who see this as a necessary means to destroy or incapacitate Hamas and ensure the release of the hostages, which isn't to say that they support the prosecution of this war in every aspect or the impact on the civilians of Gaza. But there is direct criticism of Netanyahu for A, allowing the security situation to deteriorate to the point where October 7th could happen, and also not just failing to return the hostages, failing to destroy Hamas and return the hostages, but also the way that, perhaps unsurprisingly, Israel's standing as part of the international community has deteriorated hugely, which in itself is interesting because that's always been one of his key offers. I, Bibi Netanyahu, am the only person that can represent Israel in the face of international mm-hmm. hostility.
I mean, it's one of those things, though, where whatever else you may think of Benjamin Netanyahu, when you do have a situation where a group like Hamas has taken dozens of hostages, your good options are extremely limited. Would he not have been under just as much pressure if of a different kind if instead of prosecuting this merciless war against Hamas, he had prioritised the return of the hostages above all other considerations?
That's what happens when you're in government. You have to make unpopular decisions. The issue there, I think, is it would have been particularly unpopular with the constituency, the very far right constituency that he relies on to keep in power. And that's the other crucial aspect here is he faces numerous legal cases and accusations of corruption and so on. He needs to stay in power to avoid that. As long as the war continues, there are the calls for fresh elections have been fairly muted, even though this level of protest in the midst of an ongoing war is quite unprecedented.
It is remarkable, and the protests, as you've suggested, are not small. The organisers are claiming 100,000 plus, and measured against a country as small as Israel is, that is a measurable chunk of the population. But as you've also intimated, how big a threat to Netanyahu are not the people broadly to his left, as I suspect most of these protesters are, and obviously to the left of Netanyahu is a fairly wide expanse of the spectrum. But pressure from the right, reported today that the National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is regarded, I think, as the headbanger's headbanger, says that Netanyahu would no longer have a mandate to serve as Prime Minister if he does not launch a full-scale offensive against Rafah.
Well, look, he's talking the big talk. I mean, but and he was excluded. You know, him and the right have been a little bit edged out of recent meetings and recent decision-making processes. The fact is that without them, Netanyahu's government will crumble, but also without Netanyahu, their chance of being part of the government is also out of reach. Netanyahu, even considering the headbangers of his government, is not that far to the right by Israeli standards. He's pragmatic. His number one priority is to remain in power. And there are certainly very far from left-wing, but pragmatic figures in his government that would be there and would be quite popular in terms of forming a new government. So Netanyahu relies on the far right. The far right relies on Netanyahu. But outside pressure has been stepped up to the point where it's really impossible to see Netanyahu being able to resist the pressure to make concessions.
Well, he is also under considerable pressure, we should note, from outside Israel. Israel's usually absolutely rock-solid allies, among them the United Kingdom and the United States, have been increasingly vocal in their discomfort with how Israel has waged this war in Gaza. We are near enough now to 6 months into that as well. Do we yet, though, have a clear idea of what Benjamin Netanyahu thinks the post-war situation will or should look like? If he is thinking ahead another 6 months, has he articulated any vision of a new settlement?
Settlement is being
possibly the poor choice of word now that I say it.
I mean, look, Netanyahu also embodies the very Israeli trait of what they call in Israel improvisatia. So this is one of the reasons that the IDF is a very agile fighting force, is one way to put it, and also Israeli innovation. And that, but planning ahead, this sort of strategic versus tactical planning is not a strong characteristic, and certainly not for Netanyahu. As I said, he is playing this moment by moment, week by week, to try and stay in power as long as possible, ward off the legal action against him. We've had some quite clear indications of what will not happen. So there won't be, Hamas will not be in a significant position of power after the end of this. There have been all kinds of ideas mooted from Mohammed Dahlan, who was the former Palestinian Authority strongman in Gaza, being sort of put in position to take over the PA, which is already pretty defunct in the West Bank, having a role in administrating Gaza. Because also the day after the fighting ends, and really there's no sign that that day will be anytime soon, Gaza has been vastly destroyed in terms of infrastructure, 85% of the population displaced. When the international media, if and when they are allowed in, then we'll learn even more about the extent of the crisis there. So the question is very far from, well, OK, the fighting will stop, people will return to their homes, and a new form of government will be instituted. There's a long, 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 long road to go down before that happens.
Daniela Pellad, thank you, as always, for joining us. Now, here is Laura Kramer with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The UN nuclear watchdog has urged restraint after the Zaporizhia nuclear plant was attacked on Sunday. Russia says Ukraine is behind the attack, which it said injured three people. Kyiv has denied involvement. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency has warned such attacks significantly increase the risk of a major nuclear accident. Almost 100 people have died, including children, and more than 20 are missing after a ferry boat capsized off the northern coast of Mozambique, according to the country's maritime body. The vessel was an overloaded fishing boat and was not licensed to transport people. State media has reported passengers were fleeing a cholera outbreak. And finally, a Brazilian judge has opened an investigation of Elon Musk for obstruction of justice. This comes after the tech mogul said he would defy a court order to remove X accounts accused of spreading disinformation. We'll hear more about this later in the show. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Laura. This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller, and two disquieting tidings now for any listeners who may have excitedly welcomed the 2021 inauguration of AUKUS, the Trilateral Security Pact embracing Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, by purchasing souvenir tea towels. The acronym may be about to change. Reports suggest that AUKUS might shortly become JAUKUS, at the very least, with the welcoming aboard of Japan. Other potential partners are believed to include Canada and New Zealand, raising the spectre of JAUKUS-kins. I'm joined now by Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times. Michael, first of all, let's start with what we do know, which is that Japan seems to be being drawn into AUKUS. Why do the three established partners want Japan in?
Well, first of all, they think Japan itself is fairly vulnerable to pressure. Secondly, because pressure from China, that is. And secondly, because they feel that AUKUS is a very important way of developing a containment strategy for Southeast Asia to stop China spreading its influence right across the South China Sea and potentially causing tremendous problems with Philippines and various other neighboring countries, which feel that China is encroaching on their waters.
There's been care to delineate that Japan would not participate in what they are calling Pillar One, which involves the acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines, which is something Australia decided to do, much to France's displeasure at the time, because France thought they were selling submarines to Australia. But Japan won't. Why is that? Is that just because Japan, which I believe has something to the order of 23 boats already, thinks it has enough submarines and doesn't need to participate in this?
No, I think it's more because the first phase, the first pillar of AUKUS, needs to be consolidated. It's only been signed since 2021, and integration of what's needed, particularly in submarine warfare and in the development of new nuclear submarines, does involve considerable cooperation and participation among the three nations. When that's settled down, Pillar 2 is a broader expansion of the agreement, which would involve collaboration in technologies such as undersea capabilities, hypersonic weapons, and things of that kind. And that's where Japan could come in and make a useful contribution. There is some doubt whether Japan has sufficient security of its own facilities, so that it would not be vulnerable to snooping and pressure from outside. But clearly Japan does want to be involved in what looks like the genesis of a sort of Southeast Asia NATO, the idea of containing China by bringing friendly countries together in a sort of defensive alliance. I mean, that AUKUS looks like the sort of genesis of that kind of arrangement.
We will come shortly to the question of how delighted China is going to be by that prospect, but is there also a cosmetic aspect to the desire to bring Japan in, i.e. to have at least one actually Asian country in a defensive alliance focused on the Asia-Pacific? Former Australian Prime Minister Paul Keating was, of course, very critical of AUKUS, which he called a manifestation of, I quote, a jaded and faded Anglosphere.
Well, yes, I think that could well be a reason. Certainly, it looks better if it's focused on the security in the region to have those countries clearly in the region, and clearly Asian countries taking part. And Japan has been very keen to make sure that its allegiance to the Western Defensive Pact, or the Western way, the Western economies generally, the Western world, is specifically acknowledged while being an important Asian heavyweight itself, economically as well as politically. So I think that is important, and I think Japan wants to make sure that its close relations with the United States, which go back right since the end of the Second World War, are formally acknowledged, and that it is not left out with some new pact being drawn up that sidelines Japan.
We've alluded to China's likely displeasure with this, but what can we actually expect from them, both in terms of rhetoric and action? China is obviously famous for reacting to the vaguest perceived, even imaginary slight or curtailment with extraordinary fits of temper. So they're really not going to be happy about this, are they?
They certainly are not. No, they're going to be extremely angry. They will be aggressive. They'll make a number of statements accusing the United States, Britain and Australia of ganging up on China, which is what they said the very first time when AUKUS was mooted and then implemented. And particularly, they will be angry by the inclusion or possible inclusion of Japan, because separately, they have had a long ongoing quarrel with Japan, more or less since the end of the Second World War, over what they see as Japan's refusal to acknowledge its guilt in the Second World War, its dreadful treatment of the Chinese, and indeed its glorification to some extent of some of its own war dead at the famous cemetery where some of the spirits of the war criminals were remembered there. There's a big sort of long-standing bitter feud between China and Japan. It's been slightly moderated in recent years, partly for economic reasons, but partly because the Chinese have got other things to focus on. But I think this would rekindle this animosity, and certainly the Chinese, I don't know exactly what kind of threats they would make, but they will be accusing the West of ganging up on them.
Michael Binion at The Times, thank you as always for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing on Monocle Radio. In the early stages of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there was considerable and reasonable concern about the nuclear plant at Zaporizhia. The plant, which includes 6 reactors, is the largest in Europe. When it was seized by Russian forces in March 2022, Ukraine's government sought to raise the alarm about the combination of nuclear reactors and incoming artillery. This weekend, the plant was struck again, apparently by drones. No serious damage appears to have been done, but the International Atomic Energy Agency has urged restraint. Russia has blamed Ukraine for the attack. Ukraine denies involvement. Well, I'm joined with more by Lada Roslitsky, founder of Black Trident, a defence and security consulting group in Ukraine. Lada, what do we know for sure about this attack at the weekend?
Well, we know that it happened, and we know that the Russians are always going to accuse the Ukrainians of attacking their own territory. We know that the station is a crucial and the largest station on the planet, and we're really concerned that the international community is not doing anything to protect the plant itself.
I mean, would either side, which is to say either Ukraine or Russia, actually benefit from doing this on purpose?
Well, Ukraine wouldn't benefit, of course, because it's territory, its people, its environment, and it would cause a huge environmental catastrophe all the way into Europe. What the Russians can benefit is this is a sort of terrorism, a nuclear terrorism, where they continue to frighten Ukraine's allies and really pushing for support on the Russian side for so-called peace, which is actually winning the war on the Russian side.
Does that now seem to be part of Russia's strategy? We have in recent weeks seen a spate of accelerated attacks against Ukraine's energy infrastructure.
Yes, it's ongoing. It's actually unreasonable that Ukraine's skies have not been closed over particular critical infrastructure, such as the station. And it's going to be more intense. The fact that Ukraine doesn't have enough armament and support from the allies, particularly the United States, has a direct impact on the level of death and terror here every single day.
So it is the case now that those holdups in funding, those holdups in munitions are starting to have an effect on Ukraine's ability to defend itself.
Yes, and to defend itself, and it's also having a very serious impact on the morale of the people on the ground. So we need the support. We need the F-16s. We need to have the radio warfare apparatus, and we're not getting it.
I mean, a big part of this problem is, of course, the holdup of funding from the United States, which is being becalmed by the Congressional Republican Party for largely domestic political reasons. But the UK's Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, is going to Washington, D.C. this week. He and his French counterpart, the French Foreign Minister, Stéphane Séjourné, have written a joint op-ed sort of vouchsafing their resolve to help Ukraine. And they even use the phrase to ensure we defeat Russia. Is that been reassuring to Ukrainians, especially the, I guess, the harder line that French President Emmanuel Macron has taken recently?
Absolutely. The fact that Europe seems to be waking up to the national security threat that Russia faces to them, is definitely making Ukrainians feel better because we do need the support and we're starting to feel that finally the threat is starting to be recognized. At the same time, under Trump's presidency, and we keep hearing from the Republicans that Europe has to step up and kick in. We hear a lot of anti-NATO rhetoric still coming from the so-called radical Republicans. So it's a very tense year for us. And at the end of the day, the Ukrainians right now are the ones who are dying. But maybe next year it's going to be people in other parts of the world, in our allied states.
In that context, and I guess looking at the energy war as it is directed in the other direction, were Ukrainians a bit bemused by those remarks from the United States, from Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and others, urging Ukraine not to strike Russian energy infrastructure inside Russian territory?
Of course. And this is extremely dangerous type of rhetoric, which can negatively impact the perceptions that Ukrainians have here of democratic values and principles. They're feeling quite a bit let down, betrayed to a great degree. Let's remember that Ukraine did give up the third largest nuclear arsenal, and President Obama facilitated the removal of over 145 kilograms of highly enriched uranium from Ukraine, which was then handed to Russia. So the dark cynicism of Western politics is actually feeding the Russian narratives, not only in Ukraine, but also in the Middle East.
Lada Rozlitsky at Black Trident, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Finally, on today's show, we are joined in the studio by Monocle Radio's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, for a flick through some of the day's other top stories. Fernando, as is often the case when you join us for this spot, this is heavily South America focused, as indeed are you. So where are we starting?
There will be a lot of spats today, as I said on the menu clip.
I do enjoy a spat, so I'm quite excited about this.
I do enjoy. We start in Brazil. It's the main story there in the country. So Brazilian Supreme Court Judge Alexandre de Moraes, a very well-known judge, he opened an investigation on Elon Musk's ex. And the reason for the investigation, because Alexandre de Moraes is known, to fight spreading disinformation, fake news, and he wants to ban some accounts on X. that spread disinformation. And of course, Elon Musk said, basically Elon Musk, he thinks he works for the Brazilian government. He said he should resign or be impeached. That was Elon Musk's decision. And there is the risk. It is a real risk that X might stop working in Brazil, not because of Alexandre de Moraes.
Don't threaten Brazil with a good time,
exactly,
Fernando.
Exactly. So there's a big spat there. And of course, it shows the divided political climate in the country because Bolsonaro supporters mm-hmm. are very much pro-Elon Musk.
You amaze me.
Yes. I mean, look what Bolsonaro said about Elon Musk just, a year ago. He said he was a legend of liberty. So it's a divisive topic in the country. And Alexandre de Moraes, although I do agree in a big part, because we have to fight fake news and disinformation, but he's very much kind of a star judge. And there's been some criticism that our Supreme Court is at times quite political. Mm-hmm. So it is a divided topic. So we have to, see from both sides of the coin here as well.
Well, let's move along to the day's other spat. And this is Ecuador versus Mexico. Why have Ecuador and Mexico got into it?
So on Friday, Ecuador, basically they broke diplomatic relations between both countries. And it's quite serious because police raided the Mexican embassy in Quito. And the reason for that, they wanted to arrest a former Ecuadorian vice president, Jorge Glass, who was seeking asylum at the embassy since Friday. That's quite serious. I mean, because
it is no small change to send your own police into a foreign embassy compound.
Absolutely. And of course, we have to see here the accusations against Glass here. Apparently, there was some embezzlement accusations, and he was the vice president under leftist Rafael Correa. Mm-hmm. But one thing that is quite interesting about this, that most Latin American leaders condemned Ecuador, and it was not just from the left. So, of course, you have Brazil, Colombia, but even the leaders of, Argentina, Uruguay. So it's been widespread condemnation. It's been quite a serious thing, but I don't know what's going to be the development. Of course, all the members of the Mexican embassy in Quito, they are in Mexico at the moment. This has been quite serious, and I wonder how long it will take for both countries to kind of, get back together in a way.
I mean, is there any mechanism in place for returning Vice President Glass to face Ecuadorian justice, or are Mexico going to say, no, he's claimed asylum, we will offer him asylum?
Well, from my understanding, I think he is already in a prison, in a security prison at the moment. So probably he lost that chance to ask for Mexico for asylum. So yeah, very controversial story from the region.
We should finally look at the life and legacy of Zeraldo, the Brazilian cartoonist, whose passing is being widely mourned.
Yes, very much. He's a Brazilian icon, he died on Saturday. And Andrew, he's most known for a series of comic strips called Menino Maluquinho, or The Nutty Boy. It's a lovely little cartoon about a young boy with a pen on his hand. Mm-hmm. It's very, very beautiful, beautifully written. But Ziraldo was also very important against the fight for democracy in Brazil. So he was one of the founders of O Pasquim, which is a satirical newspaper launched in the mid-60s, I believe. Quite critical of the military dictatorship, but they had to be discreet with their criticism, otherwise they would be banned. So he's very much kind of a political figure in that sense as well. It was quite difficult to make the newspaper, so then he moved to children's books, but very clever ones. So Ziraldo was a legend, and we have to pay a little tribute to him as well.
It is interesting that, as you suggest, he was able to keep functioning during those long decades during which Brazil was governed by people not known for their sense of humour. How much of a risk was he running, making fun, even very obliquely and subtly, of the military dictatorship?
Very lot of risk. He's been arrested, as some of his other kind of journalists at the time. So he was, it was a risky thing to do. And the newspaper is known till today. I think they tried to revive a decade ago. It didn't really work out. But I've seen copies of the old paper. It was very, very clever. And it's something that, unfortunately, we don't see in the Brazilian newsstand these days as well.
I mean, he was a very old man. He was 91. This is a long life as well as a full one. But in summing the late Zeraldo up, how would you say he encapsulates the Brazilian sense of humour? What did he tap into that made Brazilians laugh, which he did over many decades and several generations.
I mean, he was so Brazilian. Every picture you go you go on Google and you type Ziraldo, he's smiling. And even O Menino Maluquinho is a very simple story of a 10-year-old boy. But I think there is this innocence as well that I think, you know, I connect Ziraldo with Brazil. And Andrew, guess what? He was a big football fan. I mean, what a surprise. But he was indeed. He was obsessed. So in that sense, he's very much connected to the country.
And his pictures are on the front page of every Brazilian newspaper?
Of course. And the nutty boy, O Menino Maluquinho as well.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds and Vincent McAvenny. Our researcher was George Ruskin. Our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.